Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Whitney Racklin. I am the Chief Marketing Officer at Yield Street and your moderator for today's episode of The Yield, which is Yield Street's award-winning podcast. I'm thrilled to have all of you join us today for this live conversation around the myths of women and investing. This is our inaugural panel, the first of several, all around topics around women and investing. So if you like today's conversation, look out for our next podcast, which will be broadcasting in July. Before I continue, some quick housekeeping. I will be speaking to our amazing panel today for the first 45 minutes, and then we'll be opening up the floor to questions. So feel free to add your questions to the chat and we'll save some time towards the end. So let's get started. We've heard it all. Women just aren't as good investors as men. We don't take risks. We need to be more educated around investing and all of the marketing needs to be pink, which is my personal favorite. But they're all myths and that's what we're going to talk about today. I am joined by three highly respected women, investment professionals, and longtime advocates for female investors. How about the three of you introduce yourselves? Barbara, why don't you start?
Thank you. It's a delight to be here with two of my favorite people in the industry. Well, three, including you, Whitney, my new acquaintance. I have a background as a chartered financial analyst. I started out as a currency trader, and then I became a portfolio manager for over 20 years. And then I saw the light and decided to quit my job and follow my passion, which has been the research I've been doing for the past 11 years called Rich Thinking. And I've now interviewed over 850 really smart women all over the world from diverse ages, professions, and backgrounds. And I'm excited that I'll be able to integrate some of my findings in this discussion today. I'm also somebody who likes running, so I run 10K every day. And anyone who follows me on Instagram knows I love Bernese Mountain Dogs, and I'm on my fourth one. So there you have it. Over to Jane.
Thank you, Barbara. And I am a big fan of your dog and your epic running skills. Jane Barrett, I'm the Chief Advocacy Officer at MX. We're a data and software platform for credit unions, banks, investment companies. We basically center around the mission of empowering the world to be financially strong. I came to financial services in a fairly oblique way in that I had grown up as a marketer, had many investment services companies as clients. And I used to joke, not a funny joke, but used to joke that why don't you all just change the taglines to give us your money, boomers, because that's all they seem to want to do. And one too many people basically said, if you're so smart, then go do it yourself. So I did that. I actually left, founded a fintech platform that was investing for beginners, have done a lot of work in the financial education space across both personal finance and investing. So I became an RIA later in life, a registered investment advisor later in life, and now work through larger institutions to sort of bring the goodness of both technology and content to life.
And I guess last and least, I'll give a little bit about myself. Hi, I'm Meredith Jones. Today on this podcast, my hair is being played by Susan Tarandon from the Witches of Eastwick era. I am a 23-year veteran of the investment industry. I've worked across hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, long only, and for the last 8 years or so have been specializing in responsible investing and ESG integration. In addition to that, I've been a longtime researcher in gender and investing. I wrote a book in 2015 called Women of the Street, Why Female Money Managers Generate Higher Returns and How You Can Too. I've testified in front of Congress on the topic, and I'm generally an industry gadfly when it comes to trying to convince folks that the more people on Wall Street that are women, the richer everyone will be. And to that end, I also sit on the board of directors for a nonprofit that provides a year of financial literacy to high school girls in an attempt to build the funnel into the industry.
Excellent. Thank you all. So now you know why we're so excited to have these three women on our panel. So let's get started. Number one, and the biggest issue we have here is, what are the myths and what are the realities about women in investing? And Barbara, I'll have you kick off again.
Okay, we're going to talk about five main myths. There are more than that, but we'll focus on the five. And I'll talk about each one and kind of my research findings around that. And then we'll ask everybody to collaborate. So the first main myth is that women are not confident as investors. Has anyone heard that one before? This is probably the one that irked me throughout my career the most, because as a portfolio manager, I worked with so many strong and female investors. I just knew there was something wrong with the stereotype. And it was really the impetus, this anger that I had, to change my career and do research and counter all of these negative messages with positive messages. So that's what we're doing today. But you could ask any woman, it doesn't matter how many degrees she has or how many billion-dollar deals she's worked on, you could ask her, are you confident with your finances? And most of the time, and you can try this at home, ask anyone, they'll say something along the lines of, I should be doing more. I really am not doing enough with my money. So women, we all seem to tend to be a little bit self-deprecating. And this is an issue that I think every one of us has to work on if we're going to change the global conversation, as I like to say, around women in finance. But actually, is confidence even relevant? And I would argue no. And that's why I think that all of the bank surveys, sorry to pick on banks, but they still continue to ask this archaic question and get the same answer, obviously. What's relevant is competence. And as it turns out, women are incredibly competent investors, and we have lots of data on that, which is actually what matters. So the research I do, I try to follow actions, not words, because women are self-deprecating. Don't look at what they say or don't listen to what they say. Look at what they're actually doing with their money. And on that, we'll get into that in another one of the myths, and we can prove with some of the data on that. But on the confidence issue, I'd love to hear from Jane and Meredith and your perspective.
I think it's very similar to imposter syndrome. Maybe what we're comparing ourselves to isn't right. Let's just go, maybe it's not that women are less confident or underconfident, maybe that men are overconfident. Let's just say that. And I think how women show up in the world with confidence, especially, is, you know, very measured. And it's not that it's bad, it's just that it's more measured, because Australians have a thing called tall poppy syndrome. You stick your head up too high and the head of the poppy gets cut off. And that is very true for just sort of women in business generally, women in social surroundings. And so to pop up and say, like most bros would, I'm a rockin' investor, like some random, you can have 30 years experience and some, you know, 25-year-old straight out of school will take you to task to try and make you prove it. So I think it's a myth that can be thrown out for good, but definitely countered with, maybe the benchmark is wrong and maybe the overconfidence of the other gender in the investing world is actually the problem, more so the women's lack of confidence.
And Jane, I think that's a great point. I mean, there was actually a study that was done. It's one of the ubiquitous studies on gender and investing that came out in 2001. And no column about gender and investing or book about gender and investing is ever complete without citing this particular study, which is by two professors, Barbara and Odine. And what they found was that when you looked at men and women who were investing in their brokerage accounts, and they looked at 35 35,000 brokerage accounts, that the women in their sample actually outperformed. And the reason that they outperformed was because the men in the sample were all overconfident. And that overconfidence when you're investing leads you to believe that every decision that you make is a good one, whether it's to buy in that moment or to sell in that moment. And so as a result of that overconfidence, you tended to see that men's returns were eroded by that overtrading. Because again, if all your ideas are good, you're going to tend to trade on them more often. And so actually overconfidence is a negative. And so being appropriately attuned to what your knowledge is and what your skill set is really a measure of success. And not thinking that you know more than the market does 100% of the time. And, you know, I think we do all see this. I dated a guy one time who every time someone asked me a question about what I did, he answered it, even though he wasn't in investing. So, you know, it's one of those things that I think we are tarred with that brush. But when you get right down to it, it's actually one of the things that makes our trading hygiene perhaps a little bit better.
Where is that guy now, I wonder?
No longer dating me. I know you're shocked by that.
Okay, myth number two, women are risk averse. Guess what? Women aren't risk averse, they are risk aware. And that's the best phrase I've ever coined, and it's been the most tweeted for many of the presentations I've ever done. And I think that rephrasing is very important on a number of levels. One, risk averse is a very demeaning term. Who needs that? Actually, women are risk aware, which is an incredibly positive skill set. That's why women do well as compliance officers. The majority of compliance officers are women. Forensic scientists is a field where the majority is women. One of the women I interviewed a couple of years ago in Vegas in the police unit said 35 of the 36 forensic scientists are in fact women. So what I found through my research is that women may take a little bit longer to make an investment decision, but that's because they're doing their homework. They may be a bit more detail oriented. That's a damn good thing, because when they do end up taking the risk, it's a very calculated risk. And this is why women will make the best clients for investment firms, because they become confident in their decision, they've done all the homework around it, they've taken the calculated risk, and they're the most loyal clients you could possibly have. And one of the key issues in our industry that I'm constantly battling is that if we don't change this particular stereotype, then women will be advised by sort of more traditional advisors to stay in short-term bonds and cash equivalents and things that will not perform for them over time. And that is just a tragedy. So bad advice from traditional advisors is going to hurt women. So we're pushing hard against this one. I did a quant study, a global quant study in 2019 to test out the numbers on this. And the numbers came back when I gave women more choices rather than just ticking, am I conservative? Because again, we'll say we're conservative by just deferral. I gave them options like, are you a risk seeker? Are you a risk taker? Are you risk aware? Are you risk averse? And fewer than 10% of the women said they were risk averse. So that means 90%, by my calculation, are either risk aware, risk seekers, or risk takers. That's huge. Comments? Jane? Meredith?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is that a lot of the research actually shows that there is a difference between how men and women weight probabilities. And so there was one really interesting study that I cited in my book where they asked women and men to estimate what they thought they would pay for a new car they were going to go buy. And then they actually sent them all out to buy a new car. And overall, the prices they paid were pretty similar, but the deals that the men in the sample thought they were going to get were much, much more substantial than the deals that the women thought that they were going to get. And so that's also something that can play a really important role in trading hygiene, that if you have outsized expectations, it's going to cause you to take more risk. And so that matching of expectation with reality can result in a more muted profile, but it also can deliver very consistent returns over time, which of course is, you know, we tend to see on the front page, you know, the huge trades that made tons of money in a single trade. But anybody who's in investing knows that the consistent application of an investment strategy and the consistent generation of reasonable results is really what gets you to be a wealthy person or a wealthy fund manager or wealthy anything. So that those characteristics I actually take as being a good thing.
I think that's a great point, Meredith. And I think just to build on, I think there is an inherent flaw with KYC when a person comes on as an investor, especially as a relatively inexperienced investor. When do they get the chance to build their risk awareness or their risk? I always talk about them as risk muscles, and the more that you use them and the better you feel, the better developed the muscles will be. And I think there's been a tendency for the industry to put you in a box as an investor, and this is where you stay because that's your risk. It's like, but I'm 28 and I didn't know anything. And I just like, you know, my teeny tiny little investment that could have skyrocketed over my lifetime didn't, because it was in a low risk because I didn't know anything at 28. And so I think changing the conversation. So one, changing the conversation from just sort of risk as a static thing to risk as a muscle that can be developed over time is really important. And then the second thing is this revisiting of KYC. And I think, again, traditional advisors look at that risk is something that has to go down over your lifetime. But what if you've got this great diversified portfolio outside of what that advisor is advising you on? And, you know, again, you've left money on the table. So I think KYC could go a really long way if you had a true 360 view of a human.
Yeah, I used to fire financial advisors when I would walk in and they would recommend you should be in an annuity. And I was, you know, 25, 20, you know, 30, 35. I went through at least six first meetings with financial advisors where I either did not hire them or fired them for that sin alone, for just assuming that that's what I would want.
We've still got so much work to do. Oh my God. Ah, okay. Myth number three. Oh, this one. Women are not interested in investing. Did you know that?
Well, I do it as a hobby. Really, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that little thing over there. Well, actually, what women are not interested in is the poor communication style of an archaic investment industry. The communication in the industry has been almost universally ineffective over the years, and that's why we've seen so many women with too much cash. If they don't understand what you're talking about, because you're not talking in a language that makes any sense, why would they bother taking your advice? So that is a huge thing in the industry. And I'm going to throw that over to Jane in a second. I just want to give you some numbers around this too, because it's so critical. The actual numbers showing who's investing and who isn't, what I'll call the retail investing gap. This is equity investors on the S&P 500. Historically, there was a 20-point gap between men and women, equity investors. That's changed. That's back from the 1980s. That's changed radically. During the financial crisis, this is from Gallup poll data, that gap narrowed to 6 points. And in 2017, which is the most recent I have, it's narrowed to only 4 points. So we're very much closing in on this retail gender investing gap, much better than people think or talk about. And I would argue that post-pandemic or during the pandemic even, I haven't seen the data come in, we're probably at parity now, because the Financial Times, for example, reported a couple of months ago that the numbers on these online trading platforms for women versus men have been dramatic. I mean, huge. For example, eToro out of Tel Aviv said since January 1, 2020, women's numbers have increased by 366% on that platform versus men who've increased by 248%. And then European platform Bux said the number of women signing up to its share trading app, Bux Zero, grew by 600% year to date. And that's compared to 400% growth for men. Wow. Jane, I want you to comment on communication in the industry, please.
Oh, I mean, it is such rich territory around the not interested, because at some point I will do a big, long wall of shame of all of the comments I got back when I was fundraising to do an investing for beginners platform. And because I showed up as a human woman, everyone just assumed it was for women. I'm like, well, it's for beginners, but you know, clearly all the men somehow know how to do this already. But literally, why my wife's not interested, so women won't be interested. All women want to do is shop and spend the money. Ha, 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 such a funny joke. But the closing of the gap, I think, and I think we'll talk about technology a little later, but there's probably, the technology availability is a huge leap forward. If you do not have to go and show up in some weird leather paneled office to talk about money, I'm totally there for that. But B, the conversation has always been so impenetrable in that it was just like, you know, to a sports analogy, it was like inside baseball. The language was all wrong. It was very, you know, hyper-competitive and almost like military-esque language around investing, which, and it goes on and on and on and on. So the communication of the old school world to what we have now with these modern investing platforms across the spectrum is night and day. It's like a different century now. So I'm not surprised that the numbers have closed, but you know, the industry has been opaque. The industry has been lazy. The industry has been completely whitewashed, targeted boomers. I mean, it's just been embarrassing to the point of reinforcing the stereotypes of, you know, women clearly aren't interested in investing because every ad shows Silver Fox on the beach with his hot Silver Fox wife who's just smiling cutely, right? It's just this, it's a very, it's still a long way to go on communications because honestly, so much of it out there reinforces the myths, even though they are wrong, as your numbers show, Barbara.
Meredith, your comment?
Yeah, well, I mean, Barbara, I think you know not to get me started on this, so I'll try to keep this.
I want to get started a bit.
These comments very brief. So a couple things there. I do think that the industry has made it difficult perhaps for women to be as interested in investing in finance because as I often tell people, I have friends in the industry who had to remind their colleagues to speak to the women in the room when they were dealing with couples. And so if you are being systematically ignored, if your needs are being ignored, so for example, you know, women have longer life expectancies. They, at this point, because of the gender pay gap, they have smaller nest eggs. So their financial needs are different. You can't just pink it and shrink it and hope that women are going to be happy. You can't leave women out of a couple's conversation and expect that they're going to be happy. And the proof of that is that I think the figure is something like 70% of widows fire their financial advisor when their husband dies. That is not an indication of disinterest. That is an indication of being pissed off. And so, you know, I think that, that we have to think about it from that standpoint. The other reason I think we get that reputation is because you don't see that many women in the industry still. You know, for example, registered investment advisors, about 35% of registered investment advisors are women, about 23% of CFPs are women. About 9% of mutual fund managers are women, about 2.5% of hedge fund managers are women. There's just not a lot of us. And that has a lot to do with how math education works in the United States. For example, girls start to lose interest in topics that would lead them to a career in finance around age 11. And that accelerates around age 15, which is one of the reasons why the nonprofit that I work with starts so much earlier than what you would think a traditional intervention would start. But when we do that, something like 70% of the girls we work with report that they are now interested in pursuing a career in finance or economics or something that will lead them to investing. So it's not interested, it's lack of exposure and lack of respect, I would say.
Exactly. I see there's a couple of questions popping up, and I think we're going to stick to the 5 minutes and then go to the Q&A after that. But it's great that people are asking these questions, so thank you. Myth number 4, women are not good investors.
Meredith. Take that one to the mat.
I want to give you some data before. I want the rant from Meredith, but I want to give you some data on this because I've found like so many studies now that prove this wrong. I can't imagine anyone can look themselves straight in the eye and say this. One of the studies, German Comdirect Bank, said in the 2007 and 2008 crisis, women did 4 to 6% better than men based on their study. Fidelity looked at 8 million investment accounts in 2016 And women's investments earned 0.4% more each year on average, and also women save more each year on average. And then the last one I'll quote is the Warwick Business School in the UK, which is more recent, 2018. They took a look at 2,800 investors and found that the mean returns for women investing outperformed men by 1.8%. That's significant. That's a lot of money. That's like high investment fund fees. Okay, over to Meredith's rant. Are women good investors?
I'm going to have their reputation as not only having the crazy hair, but the crazy mouth on this podcast. But you know, I think that statement that women aren't good investors is one of the things that makes me the craziest about what I do, because even though there are not that many women professional investors, even though, you know, that is used, I think, sometimes as a convenient excuse, it's something we really need to get away from, because in the generational wealth transfer, women right now control 51.3% of the investable wealth in the United States. That number is going up to 66% by 2030. We've got to get away from the fact that we're not good at this, because we're about to be in it. And also, when you look at women, 95% of women report that they are the sole or shared financial decision maker for their household. And so if you believe that you're not good with money, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so Barbara has already given some great statistics here, but there are tons of studies that show that, you know, women hedge fund managers outperform, that mixed gender mutual funds tend to outperform, that, you know, there's a pile of data, and I'm not going to, you know, kind of death march everybody through the studies. But what I will say is that the trading hygiene and things like that that I've been mentioning, the ability to be confident without being overconfident, the ability to match expected results with actual results. There's been studies that look at women tend to be buyers when men are sellers when the market is going down, and vice versa, which means that women actually outperformed substantially during the financial crisis, not just on the basis of the study that Barbara cited, but on a study of over 2 million IRA accounts. They did about 3 percentage points better during that period, because women are hardwired to internalize stress in many ways, which is why I eat all the ice cream that I eat. And men are hardwired to react outwardly to make stress go away. So in the financial crisis, for example, men were selling, because what makes the pain go away when the markets are going down and you have a portfolio of stocks? Selling your stocks. But women were able to, you know, kind of ignore some of the noise and hold on to what they had. And as a result, they captured all of the upswing. And so when you put all of the behavioral and cognitive factors together, you get a really good innate trading behavior pattern that ends up with better results. And what's more, like I said, we all have to get to the point where we're confident in our ability and confident enough in our abilities, because sisters are going to have the money going forward. So that's something that's going to be really, really critical.
It's funny, on that financial crisis bit, I'll just contribute, because I was working as a portfolio manager. And on one day, the day of the market low, I had 7 panicky phone calls, and I had equal gender representation in my client base. Guess who all the 7 people that called panicking, trying to cash out were, which gender? I'll leave that to your imagination. Jane, over to you.
So you've shared some amazing statistics, and I love hearing the anecdotes, like the where the panic sets in and the sort of the physiological reasons why. Anecdotally, one thing I found running my own platform was the gender difference in the questions that were asked and the information that was shared. In terms of, I found it very collaborative, and this wasn't just me, they were, you know, male advisors as well. Generally, the inbound requests from women tend to be quite thoughtful and broad-based, whereas the inbound from men was almost like they had to prove how much they knew first. It's like, it's okay, it's a for beginners platform. Like, you can come in, not know anything, it's okay. But I think the best insight was the fact that women make investment decisions all the time, right? Purchases for the household, how they invest their time, you know, how they're investing in education for children. Like, there's so many investment decisions that are made, but it's almost like when it came to, again, the old school, the market, it was considered a different planet. But they've made investment decisions, home-based decisions, buying maybe a cash flow business, running businesses. Like, there is so much competence in investing as a skill generally across the spectrum of life that it is completely unfair to put all of that aside and just say, just because they don't know what a PE ratio is, they're a bad investor. No, like that doesn't, but you don't get to say that. There may be a understanding gap of, like, even if it's the basics of the market. And, you know, I'm talking not just for sort of wealthier women who like actively manage a portfolio and look at portfolios, but across the board, this idea that an investment mindset applies first and foremost to the market and then everything else is fluffy is complete BS, because the biggest impact does come from real estate investment, education investment, how you've invested your time, how you invest in your community and your family. And yes, the market will provide that upside and it will provide wealth, but it's not the starting point. That's like the craziest thing that anyone can hold in their head.
I love that. And I've never actually heard that kind of analogy before. And I once had a psychiatrist who said to me, however you are in one aspect of your life, whether it's work, home, whatever, you're like that across the board. And I think that's what you're saying, in the sense of, if you're a good investor in the household or whatever, then you're going to be a good investor in the market as well. You're the
Not
same
that
person.
Different. Yes.
Same psychology. Okay, let's go to myth number five and then over to all these great questions. Myth number five is that, well, women, they're not financially literate and they need to be educated. So I've got a great study on that one. I found this gem hidden in a FINRA report in 2018, because again, this goes to some pretty poor survey questions on the part of a very lazy financial industry, dare I say it. On the survey questions, if you have an I don't know on a financial literacy questionnaire, that's a really interesting thing. Everybody should get rid of I don't know immediately for the following reason. FINRA reported that after removing respondents, this was women versus men, after removing the I don't knows from the financial literacy questionnaire, the gender gap in financial literacy completely narrowed for boomers and Gen Xers, and it actually disappeared for millennials. So those are the stats. And once again, that goes back to, if women don't know, we're going to say we don't know. It doesn't mean we're stupid. We're just going to admit it. Whereas a man might be more inclined to take a wild guess. So if we remove that, we're equally financially literate. I love it. And no, we don't need no education, I would say. From my quant study again in 2019, 45% of the women that I interviewed said that the number one reason for their investing success was that they just got started investing. And that's so, so critical. And I know, Jane, you founded an online investment platform, and what a beautiful thing that is. Can you talk about that a bit?
And it's funny, I haven't talked at all about financial education, but I have a whole separate thing going. I have a partnership with LinkedIn Learning. I have a ton of courses on financial education, everything from personal finance to investing to optimizing your portfolio. And they really are targeted, A, because it's a global audience. They're fairly broad-based. But B, it really is more around, here's what the words mean. Here's what the key concepts are. Here's the things to build on. But unless you put this into practice, there's no there, right? Behavior, there is no substitute for a behavioral change, going from 0 to 1 or 0 to 10, or, you know, just getting started. And what I hope that, and I hope A, the word literacy goes away because it's incredibly demeaning, but B, I hope what education does is at least give the starting point to say, it's fine. Oh, I didn't know that there were virtual investing platforms. Oh, I can do this and learn without putting any money in. Good. Right? They're the sort of small leaps that can be made where you can start to build those money muscles or risk muscles before you put real money in. And I think the second thing is, because again, the world of silver fox boomers out there, it's investing seems like it's for rich people. And until you show those straight lines of what $1,000 can do at the age of 20, it's like, oh, magic of compound interest. Amazing. Right? So there is a lot that can be done, but it feels like financial education, financial literacy is often such a band-aid that is put on top of, oh, that's going to somehow magically solve systemic issues in education, wage gap, you know, availability of resources, all of the things that we struggle with as a society. It's like, oh, well, if you just educate people, they'll be able to magically work their way out of systemic, you know, racism, bias, whatever it may be. And so it is a very long way to say that there is a place for financial education, especially in plain language, that is just enough to get people to do something and then learn as you go. Like, that is, if I could give one piece of advice, it would be that. Just start and learn as you go versus feel like you have to do all of the learning and then, you know, put your first dollar in.
Meredith, comments.
So I had no idea that I was using one of Jane's most hated words when I said that the nonprofit that I work with focuses on financial literacy for high school girls. So sorry, Jane. But
it's okay. It is the go-to.
Well, and you know, I think that because we work across, you know, the entire United States and in a non-pandemic year, have, you know, 750 to 1,000 girls going through the program. And a lot of them are on free or reduced school lunch, and they don't know basic money concepts, to be quite honest. And so the way I look at things is that it's a combination of education and exposure. So I grew up in Alabama, and I grew up what I like to refer to as powdered milk poor. Like, I didn't know that milk came in liquid form because we were too poor to buy it until I started going to elementary school and they had milk in cartons to buy. I thought it came in a powder. And so, you know, I always tell people it's kind of weird that I'm in the industry that I'm in. But the reason I think that one of the main reasons that I'm here is that, I had a teacher in the seventh grade who had all of us in rural Alabama start trading paper portfolios. So it was both education and exposure that I would not have had otherwise. Mm-hmm. Number two, my mom made the colossal mistake of allowing me access to a very small inheritance that came from my great uncle when he passed away. And so I started having conversations with a broker at Merrill Lynch when I was not yet able to drive. And so I was able to take some of that education that I got from my seventh grade paper portfolio and really do a quite terrible job of managing that. I took more of the Carrie Bradshaw approach at that stage of my life. I'm glad to say that my money habits have evolved significantly since I was 15 or 16 years old. But, you know, it was that combination of education and exposure. And I do think that even though the majority of women that I interact with now certainly are in zero need of any kind of financial literacy of any kind. And quite frankly, I am the person who, one of those brokers who tried to sell me an annuity also tried to explain to me where interest rates come from. And someone almost had to physically restrain me at that point. So I get it. But at the same time, I do think if we're going to create a confident cohort of female investors in the future, both retail investors and professional investors, that education and that exposure really has to happen.
That's great. Thank you all so much for all of that. I'm going to skip around a little bit. We're going to hit questions in about 10 minutes. So I'm going to throw a few more things out to you. How has technology played a role in the way women are investing and the change in investing over time?
I'll go just based on my interviews globally. It started for me, the front runners were in the Nordic countries where I first witnessed this revolution. And it was about 4 or 5 years ago, I was doing presentations in the Nordic countries. And all of these young women suddenly decided they wanted to be gender equal and they wanted to build their own platforms, build their own gender equality funds. They were egging each other on. They were just encouraging each other. This was a massive shift that I saw first there that has now really become a worldwide phenomenon, I'm happy to say. And it's just been so wonderful to have gone from a world where I grew up as a currency trader in the early 90s, where no woman would have helped me. It was dog eat dog. It was the most competitive environment, this 300 person trading room. And we had maybe 10 women out of 300, and we were at each other's throats behind our backs, of course, because these were coveted jobs that we had, and there's no way you were going to help each other. It was terrible. And now I'm so, so encouraged when I see these women. It's all about helping each other, supporting each other, and these beautiful platforms where women go on Facebook communities and they just, and they're winning all the awards now, these lovely different investment platforms. And they're all, it's all around sharing portfolios, sharing stock tips, helping women build money. It's beautiful. And both of you know a lot more about technology than I do. So I'd love to hear from you.
So I think, and I've been in tech my whole career, and a pretty profound shift happened in terms of, you know, the technology around trading and investing was always charts and graphs and tickers and, you know, incredibly dense and poor, ugly ass design. Right. So what you've seen in the last decade is a real shift towards, and across the board, this isn't like a single, but even look at like E-Trade trading screens have really changed over time to be less professional investor. And, you know, they've carved out, if you're a day trader, an active trader, here's the tools for you. But for the rest of the humans of the world, you can design your own dashboard. Like, amazing. So I think from, you know, the general utility of just the information available and what you can do and what you can track and the information you can see goes so far to increasing confidence to be able to, well, that transparency is huge. But I think you hit on something, Barbara, that's frankly even more important than the tech around investing, which again, real time and pretty well free, which is great. Like, that was a big contributor of tech. But the fact that you can now collaborate in any number of platforms, you know, a WhatsApp group, Facebook group, like the fact that there is so much more communication, that when was that ever going to happen? You know, a group of professional women get together for dinner once a quarter and there might be a little tidbit, but it wasn't an ongoing conversation. And now technology enables a much better ongoing conversation, which, you know, and even if you look at the recent crazy GameStop, like, that wasn't all just bros in Reddit. Like, that was multi-generational and multi-gender, like, all jumping in and, you know, regardless of outcome, like, was far more collaborative than what would have been a bunch of guys in a bar talking up a stock. So I think tech, and, you know, truly do believe that tech can be a force for good across, you know, across all industries, but especially in the investing world. The increased transparency, the ability for people to actually baseline where they are, right? I can look at, you know, the value of my home, the value of my car, the value of my portfolio, the value of my 401k. And even if you're doing it in Excel, you at least have a way to really visualize where you are. And yeah, I think tech has changed fundamentally on so many ways, the way that people can engage with their money.
And just really quickly, I mean, I guess all I would say is I still remember when Bloomberg terminals were the only real way to get information electronically, and they were 15,000 a pop. And so even our office was scarcely populated with Bloombergs. And so, you know, certainly the democratization of information has made just huge changes to the industry. And as a result of that, I do think that there are better opportunities for people to invest in a variety of ways, whether it's sweeping, rounding up their credit card purchases and sweeping that money into an account, whether that's being able to make small dollar trades for no money. You know, you mentioned GameStop. My mom is in a little old lady's exercise class, and her aerobics instructor made a 30 times return on her investment with GameStop. And so, you know, I think that more information is almost always a better thing. And then on top of that, when you add in that a lot of these platforms are including information on ESG or values-based investing, and when you poll women, they have a tendency to really want to not just make good money, but also do some good while doing well. And so the availability of that information and the quantification of that information by various providers, I think, has really opened up investing to not just be something that you do to, you know, that you do to gouge somebody else and make your money, but it's something that you can do and make the world a better place as a byproduct of that as well.
That's great. So next question, given my position here at Yield Street, I have a personal question around this. Yield Street is a platform for alternative investment asset classes. What are your attitudes about alternative investments and what's happening in the market? And where do you think women are overall in this space?
Well, I'm a chartered financial analyst, and in our program of study, alternative assets are supposed to make up about 15 to 20% of an overall investment portfolio. Generally speaking, everybody, of course, is a unique individual, and I have to say that it's not, you know, standard investment advice for the masses. And because, especially in this environment, bonds are kind of not really that much fun anymore for those alts, this space is exploding. And I would argue, particularly for women. I mean, now you can get fractional shares of everything, whether it's pop culture collectibles or art or whatever it is. I just invested through an equity crowdfunding site yesterday in a pet transportation sharing investment, and I'm so excited about that. This goes to women prefer to invest in causes and concerns that matter to them, which is one of the key findings I've had over the last decade. And now we have ways to make those investments. In 2017, I did a study for a Nordic bank, and I interviewed 60 ultra high net worth female customers to find out what they wanted from their bank. That's just 4 years ago. And they told me, I think it was like 94% of them said, we want ESG or some sort of product where we can save the world. And there wasn't any product available. And this is what's so fascinating. You couldn't buy a gender equality fund even 4 years ago. And look at how things have changed. And so I'm so encouraged. But yes, the space is huge for women. And the more offerings, the better, because we all like something unique to us.
And I think from putting my RIA hat back on, there was always that, you know, portfolio allocation appropriate with risk. And I would give guidance around just make sure, you know, your credit card is paid off, you're saving some money regularly, are you contributing to your 401k? Do you have like at least a starter portfolio? Then allocate stuff into alternatives, right? It was just like check, 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 work your way up the tree. And I have definitely rethought that strategy. Obviously, pay off your debts and save some money. It's important, especially high interest. But there is so much confidence and experience to be gained that we were, you know, joking earlier around gambling and how all of us are terrible gamblers, which is ironically, because I think there is this sense of we understand the risk, almost understand it too well and the potential return and what is gambling, but what is speculation, especially, you know, for people who speculated on Bitcoin a year ago, that was a really great speculation. You know, people who speculated on Bitcoin a month ago, maybe less so. So much timing. But if you were putting $100 in or $1,000 that you were going to just, you know, you've paid off all of, you know, again, your credit card is paid off, you've got your savings going, your 401k is in a good place. If you have that $1,000 and this is something that you believe in, then put it in there and watch it, you know, watch it go. It's like that alternative approach for both things that are emerging as trends, as well as things that you care about, frankly, shouldn't be, oh, this is awesome old market over here, and this giant big bucket over here is alternatives. Like these all exist on a risk spectrum. And I think the more we stop normalizing as the market is the way to go and everything else is alternative, the sooner that happens, the better, really.
Great. I'm going to start taking questions from the group. So let's start with, how do you encourage a woman who's new to investing, a younger investor, just new, how to start investing outside of 401k traditionally, which hopefully most people are taking advantage of? How do they start thinking about growing their portfolio over time?
Meredith, do you want to take that since you talk to young women?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key is to start somewhere and keep going, right? So start with your, obviously start with a 401k, you know, make sure, I think, again, women like to know that they understand what they invest in. They don't necessarily have to go with the craziest idea. And so, you know, if you've got something that you use around the house or something that you really believe in, research that. It might be a great investment opportunity. Things that you have a personal connection with, I think, can often be something that can get your toes wet in the investing industry. You know, feel free to start with actively managed products or even index products and then move into doing your own trades. I think the key here is there's really no one way, right way to get started in investing or to invest. Everybody is going to have their unique profile. And I've been talking in some generalities around how women tend to behave, but if you don't happen to match those behavioral patterns, it doesn't mean that you're right or wrong. It just means that you're different. And so, like I said, making sure that you feel comfortable, that you understand what you're investing in, that's the number one way to be able to sleep at night. Understand the risks, understand what the potential reward is. In a perfect world, I always like to have more than one path to success, if at all possible. So think about that. But other than that, like I said, your personal comfort is really going to be what matters the most, and making sure that that's money that that you can stand to put at risk. That's one of the things that's going to make you comfortable as well.
And I'd spent many years of my life on this very question. And honestly, Meredith, you nailed it so well. I also often give guidance around just virtual investing. Just, you know, try out a platform. Don't put any money in. Just see how it feels. Watch what you think your instincts are. And like, you know, an index fund. And often I will just shortcut completely. Is like, if you've got money earning, burning a hole in your pocket, just put it into a Vanguard index fund and then go from there. But just like start, do something. And that is, especially the younger you are, the sooner you start doing something and building those risk muscles, the better.
And it's actually amazing the feeling of power that you get from the second you make your first investment. And if you feel it, like, don't overthink it and just think of it as, this isn't about whether I make money or not. It has nothing to do with this. I'm doing this to educate myself. And practical education is the best. And I remember interviewing Jane years and years and years ago about when you first bought your Apple stock and the feeling that you had. And it wasn't, again, because you made so much money, although I think you did double in price.
I mean, I was a genius. I bought it a split adjusted one, so, and then sold it two. So,
the point is, you made your first investment.
Exactly.
And I think too, I mean, you've got to understand, not every investment you make is going to go well. And that's something, you know, particularly if it's early on and you have one that maybe doesn't work out for you. Look, every single person who invests has those investments. And again, that's a large part of making sure that the money that you have to put at risk, that is really money that you have to put at risk. And if, as long as that's the case and you are doing something that you feel comfortable with, you can't control everything. Every one of us on this call, and probably every person listening, could say what their worst investment is ever, because we all have one.
Right. I'm going to combine a couple of questions that have a similar theme. What are the best resources to start reading or watching to learn more about the markets and where people are going for value and growth right now? Podcasts, or another question that involved this was, are there women who you would actually follow and follow their investment patterns? And we have authors on the panel, so I'll let you talk to that as well.
Well, I would definitely recommend saying that LinkedIn Learning, because it's actually ranked as, I can't remember what, but one of the top investment courses. So start there. Do you want to elaborate a bit on that, Jane? Because I think it's...
Thank you, Barbara. Yeah, so LinkedIn Learning, even if you're not a LinkedIn Premium member, if you've even got a library card, you can access this library of resources. So I did basically investing basics and then sort of optimizing your portfolio sort of for beginners and then for people who are already in the market. And again, this is more around just broad-based. It's not advice. And, you know, all of us have, you know, had professional designations, so it's not so much advice that you can give. But I would almost caution against, I would go very broad with your, in sort of investigating and following, simply because anyone who says they have the answers, they don't have all the answers. Like, it really will come down to there's a lot of people out there selling you stuff. So what is actually being sold to me? So look at that through that filter. If someone has, you know, they have insurance products, guess where they're going to land you? Yeah, so just be like hyper cautious, but honestly, just following the news generally, getting to know a few writers like Helena Lin. I would follow Meredith Jones now over a cliff if that was where you were going to take me, quite happily. But there's some really great authors out there that do deep thinking around this that you know, can tell you a lot about yourself, because that's what it's always going to come back to. Like, where are you starting from? What do you feel like you need to learn?
So I would say read anything and everything that Barbara ever puts out. That's always a really good place to start.
Oh, nice.
I would also say, you know, if you can find some women investors or women, financial advisors that you like, and there are a number of them out there that are producing content on LinkedIn or on Twitter, although a word of caution about financial Twitter, FinTwit can be a little intense at times, to say the least. So take that with a grain of salt. But there's a lot of great people out there. To return the compliment to Jane, I would read anything that she wrote too. But a lot of your good ideas are going to come from, something, again, products you like, something that you see on the news, a company that's done something that you really agree with, and then you start researching it and you learn, oh my God, this is such a great investment for me. So, I would say the ideas should come from a variety of sources. There's no end all be all. And to echo Jane's point, a lot of us in the industry, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So just be aware that, the Bitcoin folks are going to be saying Bitcoin and the real estate folks are going to be saying real estate. And so broad reading, do the things that resonate with you personally, and you'll be in good shape.
And make it a daily habit, part of your day.
Definitely.
Reading about money.
We have another question. How do you view savings for retirement versus savings for prior to retirement?
I can't answer anything like that, because if you have a background as an analyst or a portfolio manager, you need to know about 300 more things before we can answer the personal question. So I'm happy, by the way, if you want to contact me by email or LinkedIn, I'd be happy to take that question and help you with your personal situation. Independent, no fee.
And I also, again, one of the many words I'm not a fan of in the lexicon, I don't believe that retirement will be a thing. I think it was a very short window for sort of a post-war generation. I think everyone needs to think about multiple income streams and less around a big pile of money that you gradually eat down till you die. Like, that was one, maybe two generations reality. I think across the board, it's going to be around how do you build yourself a lifestyle that can generate income and or, still feel like a contributing member of society, which is frankly what many people value more than even the income coming in. So it is a hyper privileged thing, especially within the US, given the savings rate for retirement, to think of this as some magical date where you don't have to have any income anymore. I think save as much as you can, as early as you can, invest it well, and assume that life will be long and fruitful.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. It used to be that you could retire with $1 million, and because of interest rates, you could pull 40 grand off of that a year and very easily cover your expenses. Now, interest rates are what, 8 basis points? You're not making diddly off of that anymore. And so, yeah, it investing is definitely a lifelong thing. It's not something that you stop thinking about. And again, my little old lady mother with her little old lady exercise class is still a very active investor these days, because again, the 8 basis points isn't going to cut it.
The last question, as we run out of time, for each of you, what is your top regret and top success in investing?
Okay. My top regret was listening to the voices in my head of my parents who always said, pay down your mortgage. And I really, really, really regret that, because I didn't start properly investing until way too late. And I missed a lot of good market activity. And my mortgage rate is so low. And I still have a tiny mortgage now, but it's deliberate at this point because I wanted my money in the market. And my best success has actually been this year. It makes me so happy to brag about it. I thought, hey, tech might do well during the pandemic, and maybe even after. So I bought the Qs and the NASDAQ ETF, and I think I made 70% last year, and I still seem to be doing well. Oh, I haven't even sold it. Let's see where that takes me, but I'm really happy with that.
I love that. So my biggest regret, I lived, again, in the marketing world, was on the very pointy edge of trends, who's investing in what's going on in different categories. And my biggest regret is not investing earlier against that, in those insights, because it was like literally front row seat, and that just to this day, we used to joke about it. We had a trend spotter on staff And we'd be like, ha ha, if only we'd invested in what we reported on last year. It's like, duh. And then biggest win, I think, is, it's going to sound weird, but almost like abandoning a traditional career path and investing in myself and investing in a business and going, you know, going more with instinct where I think the world is going.
And I guess for me, my biggest success and my biggest failure are kind of wrapped up together. So I was at a cocktail party in April, May of 2008. It was Bear Stearns' last big cocktail party that they had. I flew home from New York that night or the next night full of slight hangover and having caught up with a bunch of friends at Bear. And of course, that Monday it was announced that they were in a fire sale. And to say that that freaked me out would be an understatement. I went ahead and sold out of the market. I went 100% cash, which meant that I missed the entire 2008 downturn for the most part. My biggest regret, however, is tied onto that, because when the market started to bounce back, it was hard to get back in, because sometimes, as we've said, taking that first step is always the hardest thing. So I missed a fair amount of the run-up. And when you look at it on a you know, missing downturn versus missing the run-up basis, I actually ended up about break even in terms of those two behaviors. And so from that point, I decided that it was important to me to have a certain amount of money in the market at all times, that I was comfortable with the level of risk that I was taking. And then it was like that Ronco oven that they used to sell on infomercials, set it and forget it. That money does not come in. It does not go out. I do not try to time the market. I do not do anything. That is just money that is at risk all the time for me. And I'm comfortable with that. And I feel a lot better. As proud as I was of missing 2008, I am so pissed at missing the run-up in 2009. And that's the way that I've been able to get comfortable going forward. And so I would say to everybody, you know, whatever your most successful and your least successful investment is, I hope it teaches you something like that painful lesson that I learned, because now I can sleep at night and I feel pretty good about my portfolio.
Well, thank you all so much for your time and for your information and for sharing your experience with us. This was an incredible conversation. Thank you for all the participants for joining. Please follow us on The Yield. You can find us anywhere where podcasts are available. Please give us a nice review so other investors like you can find us. And check back with us next week on The Yield for Supply Chain is Like Nature. It's everywhere. Thank you all. Barbara, Jane, Meredith, it's been great speaking with you. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, Whitney. Thanks, all.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.